You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
We did this rebrand 20 years ago. Clearly, the original Hex brand is still the strongest one. So that was a failed rebrand.
Hi, I'm Rania Yallop.
And I'm Elfie Scott.
And welcome to Party Time, the podcast from SBS News, where we'll keep you up to speed on everything you need to know about what's happening in politics.
So, Rania, we are officially back. In the run-up to the federal election, we were focusing on all the big topics, all the campaign promises, and now...
Yeah, kind of doing the same thing, except focusing on what's going on in federal politics week to week. Before the election, we were talking about the plans, and now we're going to watch what's actually happening.
The business end of politics.
Exactly. So make sure to subscribe, and we'll be with you for every sitting week of federal parliament to get you across all of the big stories.
Yeah, and to kick things off, I thought that maybe we should do a bit of a recap of everything that's happened since the election, right? Rania, should we do like... a reality TV style recap of like what happened last week on Love Island style?
Yes, probably.
Yeah, okay, good. No, I thought so.
Much like a high school relationship, the coalition split up for 1 week before deciding they were going to make it work and get back together.
Sometimes if you have a relationship breakup, when you get back, and I hope we do get back together, and my intention is we do get back together, it will be greater clarity and greater focus from the time that we've spent apart.
I'm going to try and do the accent. There was a lot of debate amongst the coalition about gender quotas and climate... I'm not going to do that.
That was good.
There was a lot of debate amongst the coalition about gender quotas and climate targets.
People say the word quotas. What I think to myself is, come on, it's time to get serious about women in the Liberal Party.
Environment Minister Murray Watt approved the extension of Woodside's West Shelf gas project to 2070, which really peed off the Greens.
It just beggars belief that this week was the week that the new Environment Minister decided to make this decision to approve this huge pollution bomb.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was stood up by Trump, who cut his time short at the G7 in Canada.
But then he went to China for some panda diplomacy.
I follow a whole lot of panda videos.
He does. He does.
Oh. I see them all the time.
And do they just eat bamboo?
No.
And that's about it. That's about it in politics, right?
Pretty much. I mean, it's only been 2.5 months.
There you go. Those are the news headlines as delivered by absolute professionals. Rania, Parliament is sitting again for the first time since the election. New bombshells are in the villa, and our new old government have clear priorities, right? Including reform to HEX and improving the safety of childcare centres.
Yeah, so these are pretty clearly stated priorities, especially the HEX one that, you know, they took to the election and they said that it was absolutely the first thing that they were going to do when Parliament sat. And that's what happened. It was the first thing put on the table by Education Minister Jason Clare in the first days of Parliament.
Yeah, and just to go over it again, in case we've forgotten, in the very sleepy times since election season, the government promised to cut 20% off all existing university and TAFE debts.
So that's going to save around 3 million Australian graduates, about $5,500 each.
But I think there are still like a lot of questions around this topic, like the real world impact. There's a lot of talk about the Job Ready Graduate Scheme. I don't necessarily know what that is. And there's a bit of criticism floating around about this legislation and the cost of higher education to begin with.
Exactly. And to answer some of those big questions, we're going to chat to Andrew Norton. He's a higher education policy expert, appropriately enough.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Andrew.
Thank you.
So speaking about these changes to HEX, can I ask, why is the Albanese government so focused on this? Like, is this a cost of living pressure thing, or was there actually a movement growing for these changes before the cost of living crisis happened?
I actually don't think there was a major movement for these changes prior to the cost of living crisis. On the other hand, I think that the level of help debt and the number of people with help debt, about 3 million people, was just a political crisis waiting for its trigger point. And I think that trigger point was the indexation of help debt during the sort of COVID inflation years. And I think this was a big political negative for the government in its first term. And particularly the 20% cut, I think, was a pretty clever political move, which turned a political liability into a political strength. And I would not be the least bit surprised if the late surge in votes for the government with the last federal election was primarily due to this issue.
How many people, like you said, you think that they kind of this helped them win the election? How many young people actually have this kind of hex help debt, and how much of a burden do they like find it to be in their lives?
Well, most of the people are relatively young. So the most common age is 20 to 29 for having a help debt. I think it's about 40% of all help debtors are in that age bracket. Now, actually having the help debt in itself, you know, there's no relationship between how much you owe and how much you repay in a given year. So it's not actually an immediate financial burden unless you're in the repayment phase. But I think this is kind of playing on people's minds. They think, well, you know, I want to buy a house, do other things in my 20s and 30s, but at the same time, I'm going to have to pay off this debt. Now, this has been a problem for, as I said, for quite a number of years, but I think really it has been the indexation issue which made it front of mind.
And the changes to HEX that the government has proposed, are they changes that we're likely to feel day to day? Like, I don't know necessarily whether I look at my paycheck that much and think about how much is going to HEX. So do you think that Australians will feel it?
So the 20% cut will not have any immediate impact. All that will do is decrease how long it takes you to repay your debt. So you may not actually get that benefit 5, 10, 15 years in the future. But the changes to the repayment system will have an immediate impact on the about 1.2 million of that 3 million who are actually in the repayment phase. So that's going to do two big things. One is at the moment you have to start repaying on incomes just above $56,000 a year. That's going to go up to $67,000. So there'll be quite a large number of people who will be able to stop repaying their help debt sometime during this financial year after legislation is passed. And then once you get to that $67,000, we're going to move from a system where what you repay is a percent of your entire income to just the amount above $67,000 up to about $125,000, where it goes to 17%. So under this scheme, on my calculations, 99% of people repay less per year than they do now, and the other 1% will repay the same amount as now. So most people will receive, you know, higher take-home pay as a result of these changes.
Does that mean that it's going to be kind of more debt? Like if you don't pay debt off and it's getting indexed every year on year on year, does that mean some people are going to end up paying more of that money back in the long term?
So that's my big concern about this, that there's kind of a trade-off here between cash now and what you're going to have to pay over the long term. And I'm just concerned that particularly people who might be working part-time or something like that will get on what I call a debt treadmill, that they're either repaying nothing or less than their indexation. And as a result, their debt just keeps climbing over time and they never fully get it under control. Now, if you are worried about this, you can make a voluntary repayment, but I think most people will just go for the default, which is the compulsory repayment, which might not be enough to really bring your debt down.
Do you have an estimation of how much more it could cost someone with an average HEX debt under this new scheme?
Well, the Parliamentary Budget Office did do one or two scenarios. And for someone who's just got an average income sort of going up over time for graduates, not a dramatic impact, maybe $1,000 extra indexation over quite a number of years. Whereas someone who starts below average income and has much slower income growth, it could add 8-10 years to the repayment period and $15,000-$20,000 to the total amount of indexation they ever pay. So quite serious consequences for those people. And there'll be more people who actually never finish repaying, which in my view is bad for the government and for taxpayers more broadly because they don't get their money back.
And I mean, this is probably going to sound like a silly question, but is it fair? Like, I am obviously going to see the benefits in some way of that 20% cut. But then there are people who have been to university before me who have paid off their debts in full. And there will be people who go to university after me who won't see this 20% cut. So, I mean, is this fair legislation?
It is rather random. You know, the greatest benefits go to people who have been students recently. So graduated, they're at their peak debt, haven't made major repayments, they benefit the most. Whereas you said, you're someone who's just finished repayments, gets nothing. Someone who starts their studies next year gets nothing. And different types of students benefit more. So students doing the more expensive courses benefit more than those doing the cheaper courses. People who only do bachelor don't do as well as people who do postgrad and have higher debts. On average, men borrow more than women, so men benefit slightly more from this than women. So it's got all these random elements, but ultimately, I think this was a political decision the government made to try and win the 2025 election. It worked, and now they're delivering their side of the bargain.
I also like your term peak debt. I feel like I'm at peak debt at the moment.
Yeah, and so you are one of the main beneficiaries of this, but you know, the poor students who start next year, you know, they get nothing. And we haven't reformed the underlying way in which we charge fees, which I think is a problem here. Like, one of my key arguments in this space is always that there needs to be a logical relationship between what we charge and how we work the repayment system. So my view is if you're working full-time, whatever course you do, you should be able to repay in a reasonable number of years, and therefore the student contributions you're charged in the first place should reflect that, which is sort of the system we had before job-ready graduates in 2021, but not the system we have now.
Yeah, so on that job-ready graduate scheme, could you explain like what that is and what the impact is for students today?
So what happened was between the mid-90s and 2020, there was a scheme that roughly linked the student contributions to your likely future earnings. So there was, it was a bit messy, but basically, you know, in theory, it was kind of going down the right path. With the job-ready graduates policy, the government decided to try and use the student contributions to incentivize people to take some courses and disincentivize them to take other courses, such as arts, by pushing up the student contribution. So arts more than doubled in its cost through job-ready graduates. And this was designed to deter people from studying these courses. In my view, prices are only a minor influence on behavior, but obviously this will have a massive impact on the capacity of people who've done arts in the last few years to repay their debt.
And are there serious conversations now about like reducing the cost of degrees? Like, is that something that the Albanese government will look at?
So I think the frustrating thing for many people is they accepted the principle that this should change when they're in opposition before the 2022 election. But first, they deferred the issue to the University's Accord review, which reported in February 24, which recommended we go back to this previous system of linking student contributions and earnings. Then the government accepted most of these recommendations, but said they're going to set up this new Australian Tertiary Education Commission. So they deferred the issue again to this commission, which won't really start work until next year. So I guess my concern is that at this point, we're looking at 2027 at the earliest for this to change. You know, and meanwhile, you've had a couple of cohorts of people go through three-year arts degrees with big debts.
That would make degrees cheaper for people doing these like arts, humanities ones. But can you envision an Australia, a world in which we might get free university once again?
I can envisage it, but I think it requires a fundamental change in the nature of government in Australia. So if you look around the world, what you see is that the fees charged kind of roughly match the size of government in each country around the world. So in states in Europe, which have relatively big governments, you know, government's about 50% of a gross domestic product, they typically have free or very cheap higher education. Whereas in Australia, Asia, where sort of government's more like 35% of GDP, they charge fees. And often, if you look at sort of the OECD comparisons, are very similar fees to each other. So I think what you would need to see is kind of a much bigger transformation of Australia's welfare state for that to kind of make sense.
How did it happen before then? So, like, it just seems so idyllic in some ways for, I guess, so many students around the country right now. Like, how did it happen for the generation that came before us?
Well, we had some free education between basically 1974 and 1988. But before then, unis charged fees, which they set themselves. But most full-time students didn't actually pay them because they were, you know, there were government scholarships, there were university scholarships, people had bonded scholarships where an employer would pay their fees and then they had to go and work for that employer once they finished. That kind of system was probably feasible when you sort of had 10 to 15% of the school leavers go on to university. It's much more costly when you've got 40% going, which is what we've had sort of since the 2010s. And I think that's really the fundamental reason why we ended free education. In the 1980s, we'd had a massive increase in the percentage of people finishing year 12. We had a big demographic cohort, a baby boom coming through, and the then Hawke government decided the only way to expand the system in a way that wouldn't break the budget was to bring in HEX.
Just on the words in that as well, I call HEX debt HEX debt. Like, I feel like it's ingrained in me. Is that like the right term for it? What does HELP mean? Do they mean the same things? And why did that change at all?
So the original scheme was called HEX, and that tended to conflate both the fee that was charged and the loan. This was changed in 2005, so you had this separate student contribution and then HELP, which was designed to help repay it. So that is called HEX HELP. And since then, we've started all these other helps, fee help, which is a full fee students, you know, SA help for your student amenities fee, OS help for, you know, overseas study. So help is sort of an umbrella term for all the loans, whereas student contributions or HECs are kind of the underlying fee.
Yeah, like 15 years before I went to university and it still hasn't caught on.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we did this rebrand 20 years ago and, you know, we'll say, you know, clearly the original HEX brand is still the strongest one.
It will never not just be HEX in my brain as well, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a failed rebrand.
Thank you to Andrew for that. That was a really good summary of what's going on in higher education policy right now. And by the way, those changes to HEX, which we are just going to call HEX, those will be backdated to June 1st this year. So your debt before it was indexed.
Yeah, so on a more serious note, this week we've also seen the government introduce new childcare legislation into Parliament.
But it's not the same discussion about childcare that we were having a few months ago. Back then, it was all about cheaper childcare, but now it's all about something different, which is child safety. Right, Rania?
Yeah, so some of the what's in this bill was foreshadowed in the budget in March this year, but I guess it's been accelerated, the what they're trying to do here, after the, you know, really awful allegations that have come out of Victoria recently.
Yeah, so that's the childcare worker accused of abusing 8 children aged between 5 months and 2 years old, with thousands of children possibly exposed to infectious disease, right?
Yeah, that's the awful story. So the government unsurprisingly wanted to do something, or seemed like it was doing something, depending on who you ask. So the second bill after the student debt bill tabled in Parliament this week was the one about childcare.
Okay, so what does it actually do?
Well, not heaps. It's not just the federal government's job to ensure the safety and quality of childcare centres. Most of that responsibility actually falls with the states. What the Commonwealth does do is pay the subsidies.
The biggest weapon that the Commonwealth has to wield here is the funding that we provide that enables childcare centres to operate. It's something like $16 billion a year. And that covers about 70% of the cost of running the average childcare centre.
That's Education Minister Jason Clare, by the way. So basically the bill would give the Commonwealth the power to pull funding and effectively shut down childcare centres that weren't meeting those safety and quality standards.
That seems pretty reasonable, right?
Yeah, it makes sense. Although state and territory governments can already force centres to close down, it just extends that power, I guess, all the way up to the top of government, who is actually paying those subsidies in the first place. There's a few other parts to the bill, although it's largely administrative kind of tinkering, some stuff about payments for in-home care, family daycare, and it also allows the Department of Education to do spot checks without a warrant or consent, and allows the department to publish all of the details of breaches if and when they do happen.
What do other parties or politicians think of this?
Somewhat mixed reactions. I think everybody agrees that something needs to be done in this space to ensure children are safe when they go to childcare. Opposition leader Susan Lee says they won't go like ram it through, but were supportive of the broader idea. Bridget McKenzie from the Nationals was a bit more candid in what she had to say, though.
I think parents right around the country are rightfully anxious at the moment, as once again we're hearing of toddlers being sexually assaulted, physically abused in our childcare institutions. Enough is enough. There's been royal commissions done. We know this is an issue that not just federal government has jurisdiction over. The Working for Children checks is something that is wholly and solely within the purvey of states. And so the fact that we have had almost 12 weeks since the election and neither the Attorney General nor the Education Minister has urgently called state ministers and the sector together to quickly devise a set of recommendations that they can act to give peace of mind to Australian working families, I think, is unconscionable. Now, we have a piece of legislation, obviously, in front of the Parliament now. Is it enough? No. Will it fix the problem? No. There is much more to be done in this space, and we've acted in a bipartisan way. We'll continue to do so, but we do believe that much more urgent action needs to be taken. The education ministers aren't getting together till October, and the attorneys general aren't getting together till next month. This needs to be solved now. Get on the blower, get them up. You can have a Teams meeting, but let's get the solutions on the table and enacted so that our children are safe.
Okay, so what's that meeting about next month?
So there's more ideas on the table for that one. Things like mandating CCTV in centres, establishing a national educative register, and more regular mandatory child safety training.
And outside of like political circles, what do the experts have to say about this all?
Well, the Children's Commissioner, Anne Hollins, told me that the change was needed at all levels of government. And a lot of what was being said now is stuff that's been known to governments since the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. That's the one from about a decade ago. A lot of stuff around the Catholic Church was quite public about that at the time, but it was a much broader inquiry that looked at kind of where children are and what's being happening to keep them safe and where that's kind of failed. But she also had a comment, I guess, about accountability in this area.
There's a lot of questions being asked about why has it taken 10 years for us to now be taking seriously a lot of these measures that we were told by the Royal Commission are required to keep children safe. And, you know, it has to be something about the fact that there is no minister for whom child safety and well-being is their number one priority. Unlike for women, we've had ministers for women for decades. There are good reasons why we have a minister for women. There's also a good reason why we have women's safety as a key priority for National Cabinet, which is where the Prime Minister and the heads of the states and territories work together on issues of national significance. And a lot of viewers would be surprised to hear that child safety and well-being is not listed as a priority for National Cabinet. So I think both of those issues need to be looked at, that we're missing some key accountability mechanisms.
Thank you so much, Rania, for giving us that rundown and also for interviewing people back in the halls of Parliament this week. That was really useful.
It's okay. It is so lovely to be back here in Canberra, surrounded by everybody and back with all of you listening.
Yeah. And as mentioned at the top of the episode, we are going to be here for every parliamentary sitting week, which is not that many this year. I think it's like six sitting weeks, but we're going to be back to give you a rundown on everything that happens because they will be busy.
Lots that we know about, lots of surprises, I'm sure, on the way. But until the next time, have a good week.
Bye.